what has happened with child psychology and therapy in this country in the last few years, I believe, is truly criminal. And I'm not the only one who thinks so. I have been itching to get someone on The Spillover who is a licensed therapist concerned about the same things that I am, like what is happening to our children? Who believes that the adults in charge who took an oath to protect children are committing unethical malpractice by affirming gender dysphoria and even encouraging children to transition? When I came across my guest's Instagram, I immediately sent it to my producer. I said, do whatever it takes to get her on the show, because her hot takes in the area of child therapy felt borderline illegal in today's culture, and we love to see that. She has a master's in social work and is a licensed therapist who worked with children for 8 years prior to pivoting to consulting and coaching parents. She has worked both in schools and in private practice child and adolescent psychotherapy, as well as being an unschooling mom. She believes that good everyday people bought the lie that they were not allowed to speak on trans topics, even when those topics concerned their role and rights as parents. Now, she's on a mission to change that by helping parents feel empowered and reminding them that they have agency over their children. I cannot wait to get canceled for this episode, and neither can she. Please welcome Tava Johnstone, aka Rebel Parents, on Instagram to The Spillover. You have the craziest backstory of kind of how you got to this place where you are now. So tell us about it. And if you want to even start, just what it was like growing up in your family, what your childhood was like.
Yeah. So I was born in the 80s. I'm at the very tail end of millennial. I was born in Los Angeles in a very progressive neighborhood called Silver Lake Echo Park. It's now really trendy and hipstery, but back when we were there, it was just working class families of diverse, you know, racial and ethnic backgrounds. Yeah, I come from a mixed race and mixed religious, mostly secular family. My family is just kind of a big multicultural melting pot, if you will. And I had the classic Southern California upbringing. My parents are very liberal, progressive. My whole family is on the left. My family, we have a significant amount of activists in the family. My mom has been active in social justice my whole life. When I say that, I like to qualify it with like the original social justice, like OG social justice, not this new virtue signaling coercive stuff that we've had the last few years. But yeah, so I grew up watching my mom be really involved in doing her part to do what she viewed to be like, you know, bettering society and helping marginalized people, farm workers. In Southern California, we have a lot of farmland and there's farm workers and they're not always treated well. So she would like be on campaigns to try to get workers' rights kind of things.
And so how did you decide that you were going to go into child psychology?
I was a hairdresser. I was a hairdresser for a solid 10 years before I went to graduate school for social work. As a hairdresser, maybe you know, we're kind of like therapists. People tell us everything the minute they sit down. And I just kind of had that gift of like listening and helping people feel good about their life circumstances, like while I'm cutting their hair, right? Or coloring their hair. So, then there was like a dip in the economy in the late 2000s, like 2009-ish. And I was at this real crossroads and I decided to go to grad school. You know how that happens sometimes. So I went to grad school for social work. And social work, in case the listeners don't know, it's not only psychology. Psychology is like one component of social work, but that is the path that I focused on, which is what we call clinical social work. And my focus has always been on children and adolescents. So they place you, you get placed in these internships, and I just happened to land with kids in schools and inpatient psychiatry. And then I loved working with kids, so I just stayed on that trajectory of being in the child world.
What started happening that you were noticing that made you think something isn't right here with the way that we are conducting child therapy, child psychology? I guess I'm not sure the right way to say it, but you started noticing that a lot of these kind of social justice-y, this ideology started infiltrating the entire psychology world. What was that like?
I started to really notice that. I actually noticed it more first in the education world. So it kind of just came onto my radar about these anti-racist childhood lessons that were beginning to be taught in the classrooms post-2020. Parents were starting to get really interested in raising activist children. So I just started to notice in my professional community, we were talking about it a lot. It was all over the news. Parents, depending on if they were conservative or not, were starting to have like CRT come to their radar. So I really noticed it first in the schools and then in the parenting community of more liberal, progressive minded moms, which is where I live and who I mostly serve.
Right. And so that's interesting because most of your peers would lean more liberal. I'm assuming most of your clientele was more liberal leaning. But even though they were more liberal leaning, they were saying to you, I don't know that I feel necessarily super comfortable with what's being taught to my child in regards to either race or gender theory.
Yeah. Yeah. So parents have been very vocal with me about gender theory. Liberal, progressive parents. I don't know if you want me to go there just yet, but with the racial social justice, that I didn't have as many concerns from parents. That was more an internal concern of my own, knowing what I know about child development, knowing what I know about children's mental health. I was really concerned with the passion that schools and parents were taking up with these lessons of raising anti-racist children and these lessons about privilege and oppression versus oppressed. And I'm right there with these moms because I'm also raising, you know, a young daughter. So it's not that I'm separate from these issues. So that kind of was like, is this the best way to teach how to be a good human and how to be kind and how to help others and how to make positive societal change? Is this the best way for these kids? And so that's what really came onto my radar was the anti-racist education.
Who was the first person that you verbalized these concerns to? Was it a friend or a family member? And how did it feel to kind of be like, hey, I have some red flags about this ideology?
Yeah, I think that it was my professional community. Which is a national community. It's one organization. Not all social workers belong, but it's a national social worker organization, and they were like 100,000 members. And we had this private forum where we would just talk about things, converse about topics that were affecting our field and our clients and ourselves as social workers. And summer 2020, there was just a whole lot of conversation about race and police and CRT hit the scenes. So I think my first time really expressing, is this the best way, was on that forum in a typing written format with peers who I really trusted and respected.
What was their reaction?
Disagreement, if I'm putting it kindly.
Really? Did you feel like you were attacked?
We have a certain level of decorum, if you will, a certain level of mutual respect. So it doesn't get like Twitter, right? We're not having like dumpster fires on the forum because we're all professionals and we try to treat each other with respect. So it wasn't like a Twitter kind of pile on. And it wasn't a pile on at all, but there was just a lot of mostly white social workers who thought that not teaching our kids these, what I view to be developmentally inappropriate and dishonest lessons, dishonest because they're taught as fact to children rather than theory like you would get in a university as an adult. So that's what I mean by the dishonest.
I felt so honored when some friends of mine stayed overnight with me and they told me that I was the best hostess and provided them with everything they needed. I gave them filtered water and healthy snacks, and they also felt so pampered because I let them try my Nimi skincare. They were like, is this the Nimi skincare that you always talk about? And once they tried the hydrating cleanser, they were oohing and aahing, and they couldn't get over how pretty and clean the product smelled too, which is something all Nimi users rave about, including me. Nimi Skincare is loud and proud about its conservative beliefs. Femininity, faith, family, and freedom are values listed right on the front page of their website. And this is state-of-the-art modern skincare, but they have timeless values and they'll never go woke. I cannot shut up about their hydrating retinol lifting moisturizing cream. I use this at night and you will wake up, if you do, with brighter, glowing skin. It's one of my die-hard favorite products of all time that I discovered in the last couple years, and it will be yours too. Everything is cruelty-free, lab-tested, paraben-free, vegan, and organic. Try Nimi Skincare today and stop giving your money towards beauty brands that actively fight against what you believe. Go to NimiSkincare.com and use code AlexClark for 10% off today. That's NIMISkincare.com with code AlexClark for 10% off, or click the link in the podcast description. So the other education professionals that were pushing back on you saying, I'm not sure I agree with this critical race theory, gender theory stuff, they were mostly white. They weren't even black.
Mostly. Yeah. Yeah. Most of the social justice fervor, passion, enthusiasm in the social work community comes from white female social workers. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I look racially ambiguous. I respect that people might not always know what I am by looking at me, but I'm half black, right? I consider myself a black woman of color. So it felt a little bit strange to have these white social worker women telling me what my people need, right?
Yeah.
And just promoting these really disempowering ideas to children that I view teach learned helplessness. In child psychology, we know what compromises children's mental health. We know what's developmentally appropriate and not appropriate. So here I am trying to look out for these kids, black kids and white kids. And mostly these white social workers were telling me how I had it all wrong.
Oh, of course. And so that was a little, obviously that was startling. And so how did you go from, all right, a seed has been planted, I have these concerns, to, I think for the first time in my life, I might even vote different because these are the concerns that I have about culture?
Yeah, it was a several year process. So I think I started to have doubts in 2020 with some of the racial discourse with regard to children. It really gained momentum in 2021 with the social justice discourse for children. And then sort of late 2021, gender popped onto my radar with regard to children. And I was like, oh gosh, this is a really big deal. And once you see it, you cannot unsee it. And I view it as it's a really dark topic. So I was so disturbed by what I view to be the unethical treatment of children in schools, in psychotherapy, in just the general mainstream ideas about children and gender. I view them as inaccurate and potentially harmful. And I was so concerned about parents being bullied by activists. Parents are very aware of what's happening in culture, and they see the pylons, they see the cancellations on Twitter. They've been taught that if they're white, they're not allowed to speak. If they're not trans, they're not allowed to speak. So there's been just years of silencing. And I didn't like the idea of parents feeling bullied and silenced. I have a bit of a fight response. I'll admit that. I'm actually like a super chill, goofy person. But you start messing with the kids and I get a little bit of a fight response, which is why social work is a good career for me. Because it's about looking out for the kids, right? So I was just on this like several year journey, getting so fed up with kids not being respected, childhood not being respected, that by the time the midterms came, you know, I'm in California. We have lost the plot here. It makes my eyes water.
Yeah.
That I was like, I'm not gonna give my vote to a progressive candidate. This would be the first time in my life.
Wow.
I've been voting for 20 years. So it was a big deal. It was a big deal.
What was that moment like at the ballot box?
I vote absentee. So I actually did my ballot here at my dining table, and my daughter was close by, and I felt like, oh, you know, she gets to witness me voting. And it really did sink in for her because she commented on it later, like, oh, you voted, when she heard something about voting. But it was like, what was it like? It was almost like a drive. Like, I didn't really have to be super thoughtful, deliberate about it, because it was more like I was a single issue voter and I knew that I could not stand for how children were being treated and viewed in progressive ideology and communities, that I needed to make a statement with my vote, whether or not it did anything in my state, which I don't know that it did a whole lot, but, yeah, so I connected with some more conservative California women who had like voting, you know, guides. Mm-hmm. And I followed some of their recommendations, but ultimately I just kind of went down the ballot.
This is so interesting, because what you're saying really echoes the same concerns that a lot of the parents had in Loudoun County, Virginia. Remember that guy, Scott Smith, his daughter ended up being raped in a bathroom by the kid that identified as transgender. And so he ended up starting this whole revolution, really, with the gender ideology, at least in the state of Virginia. Yeah. And so kind of this is what's interesting to me, is that on all these other issues, liberal parents, conservative parents, we probably disagree on everything else. But really, when it comes to critical race theory, when it comes to gender ideology taught to our kids, this is a bipartisan issue. We just want kids to be kids. We think that this stuff is dangerous. And so it's something that's really bringing together parents on both sides of the aisle, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. For me personally, I'm always reluctant to use the term critical race theory, even though I know that's what people know it as, just because I haven't fully read the academic theory. And I understand it to be like an adult university level theory. But for the kids, yes, this like critical social justice, social justice ideology, gender. In some ways, I think that parents are coming together, who have more liberal or progressive views and then more conservative views. In many ways, I think we are coming together, particularly with gender. Mm-hmm. With race and anti-racism, I still think that there might be more of a divide, more of a clear divide, because I think that like white liberal moms want to raise, they want to do the right thing.
Of course.
And they want to raise children who are not racist. And they've been taught that it's not good enough to just be not racist. You must be anti-racist. Yeah. Yeah. But so, you know, maybe your viewers might be interested, and I want to talk about this more. I want more people to know this, that many of the moms I serve are mothers of color. They are raising children of color, Black women, Hispanic women, Indigenous women. None of them are teaching their kids this critical social justice stuff, because they don't want to raise children with ideas of learned helplessness. They don't want to raise children to think that all the systems are rigged against them. That's like the opposite of childhood. Childhood is about optimism and growth and your beautiful, bright future that you have ahead of you. So I just want people to know that, like, moms of color, we aren't teaching this stuff necessarily.
Yeah.
But with the gender, I do think that we're starting to come together, conservative moms and progressive liberal moms, but the progressive liberal moms are still somewhat closeted.
What do you mean by that?
They're in the closet. Like, they're not public. They're not public about their concerns and views because thus far the climate has not been accepting of voicing concerns and having questions or just flat out saying, I don't agree with that. I think conservative moms feel safer because they have the community of people who agree with them. But liberal progressive moms who are asking questions about the gender ideology, they are really risking social ostracization. And that's really hard.
This is why I'm obsessed with you, Teva, because you have every single, I don't know what you want to call it, but you have every single oppression point that the left would like to give somebody. You're mixed race, you're neurodivergent, you know, all these different things. Like, you should have everything against you. And yet you're standing up saying, I don't agree with this. And first of all, your peers around you where you live in Southern California, but also in your profession, it would be very scary to stand up and say, I disagree with this stuff, but you do it. And so that's why you're so inspiring to me, because, I mean, that can apply to so many different things in life, but feeling like, oh my gosh, if I stand up and say, I don't know about this, everyone is going to come out against me. And yet you've done it anyway. And you even pulled your own daughter out of public school. Could you talk about that decision?
Yeah. First, just let me rewind just a bit and say that, like, even though I might look like this sole person speaking out, I really do have community of other renegade professionals. So I'm not alone here. I couldn't do it by myself. It would be so dark and so isolating. Definitely not alone. I also have the support of my parents, who are lifelong lefties, who agree that this is not okay. So that feels like, okay, that feels kind of grounding. I'm close to my parents. So I'm not alone. I have community and our numbers are growing and we find each other and we support each other. My daughter, she actually never started public school. We had that choice from day one that we were not going to do traditional school. So she doesn't do public school. She doesn't do private school. We're homeschoolers. We are like non-traditional homeschoolers. So it doesn't look like your grandma's homeschool, how people say, you know.
You call it unschooling.
Yeah, we're unschoolers.
What does that mean for somebody that's never heard that term?
Yeah. So it means that, I guess one of the easiest ways to think about it is we're not trying to replicate school, the brick and mortar practices and philosophies of traditional school. We aren't really trying to replicate that at home. So we believe that education can happen outside of a classroom and out in the world, and that kids don't necessarily have to be coerced, because kids love to learn. It's the adults who kind of like train them out of loving to learn because of how we treat them when they're trying to learn in the schools. So my daughter showed me, you know, up until age 5, when most kids start school, that she knew how to learn and she was an eager learner, and that I didn't need to do a whole lot of interfering with that. So we wanted to keep that trajectory going. So we are involved in many programs out in the community where she's learning outside of the constraints of a four-wall classroom. And I'm not home playing teacher.
That is goals to me. And just so you know, I'm not married and I don't have kids yet, but I hope to one day. And I absolutely want to homeschool or unschool my kids. But I am very interested in all of that stuff. I find it fascinating. And another thing that's interesting about you, and I've never had anybody on the podcast yet who has experience working with neurodivergent kids or anything like that. But could you tell us a little bit about what it means to be neurodivergent and your experience with that in your own life?
Yeah. So neurodivergent, it's really this kind of vague, huge umbrella blanket term that essentially means that your brain works a little bit different than like the average, the typical. So if we want to get more technical, in children's mental health and child psychology, there's something called typically developing kids. And these are kids who are on a kind of standard trajectory where they're learning things at a certain time and their behavior is manageable and it's developmentally on par with what we expect. And then there are kids who have something else going on. Maybe they have a learning disorder. Maybe they have a neurodevelopmental disability or delay like autism, ADHD. Maybe they have mental health concerns. Maybe they are a foster child with an abuse or trauma history, and that history has changed the way their brain works. It really does change the brain. And then parents have like behaviors to manage. So neurodivergent, it's just this blanket term that means like you're a little bit differently wired. And it's a way to have like kind of a neutral stance on that, rather than everything's a disorder, everything's a problem or a mental illness. And I kind of walk the line because I do think that there's still room for disorders, mental illness. I don't view all different type. I don't view all neurodivergence as like just another way of being. Whereas some activists describe it that way, just another way of being. I don't agree with that.
So you don't agree with it because you think there's more to it than that or less to it than that?
I think that there's more to it than that. Someone who can't leave their house because they're so paranoid and they are hearing voices, that's not just another way of being. That's a disorder.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So I mean, like, we need to be sure that we're speaking about things accurately. The child who's cutting themselves, that's not another way of being. That's a disorder.
That's a really important distinction.
Yeah.
How can a parent tell the difference between having a slightly sensitive child or a highly sensitive child or a child with autism?
The best way to find that out is to go get a professional evaluation from a institution that you trust. Yeah, because some parents will get the evaluation and then they don't trust the results. And there are clinicians with various levels of expertise and experience, because if the child does not present classically autistic, which to most people that means a little boy who doesn't look at you, who maybe rocks in the corner, who you can't really tell, is he deaf? Like, does he hear me? You know, that's what we call more classically autistic. Maybe he's doing a lot of rocking. Not everyone presents that way. Autism is a spectrum. So if you have a child that is really bright, that is pretty socially adept, they'll look at you. Maybe they're extroverted and they actually love people. It might be harder to secure a legitimate diagnosis if you go somewhere where the clinicians are less experienced with the full spectrum of what autism can look like.
What's been going on with child psychology isn't the only thing that's criminal. How about what we've been putting in our bodies via feminine products while we're on our period? Toxic chemicals and endocrine disruptors. The irony is that the big tampon companies love to discuss women's health, and then they turn around and use a man to sell you chemically covered crap to insert into one of the most absorbent areas of the body. I'm so sick of it. So I switched to Garnu. They were created by a fellow Cutservative who believes women deserve more from their period products. Garnu tampons are 100% organic cotton certified, BPA-free, bio-based plastic applicators made from sugarcane. There's no chlorine, bleach, no dyes, no fragrance. Nothing will wreck your pH more than fragrance down there. The packaging is so much cuter than any drugstore brand you've used before. It automatically comes to your door just in time for your time of the month. And if you don't like to use tampons, don't worry. Organic pads are coming this spring. And Garnu also has period cups. One of the best parts about Garnu is that each subscription will support feminine hygiene training and female entrepreneurship to Nepali women and girls who are vulnerable to trafficking. Garnu is actually derived from the Nepali word for rescue. Period products are something you have to buy every month. So if you're buying it anyway, why wouldn't you want to support a conservative company that makes better products? Try Garnu today. Go to garnu.com/spillover and use code spillover to receive 15% off your first month of organic tampons when you subscribe exclusively for Spillover listeners. That's garnu.com/spillover with code spillover, or just click the link in the episode description. Do you think that autism has been an undiagnosed issue for centuries, or is it a modern condition?
I think that we have always had autism. People have different ideas on, are the rates higher today, or are we just picking it up better today?
Yeah.
But I do think that we've always had something that was autism. And we've been trying to refine what that is and what that means throughout the years. And with every DSM that comes out, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, our latest one is 2013. With every new one that comes out, the definition of autism to meet criteria for a diagnosis is tweaked just a little bit. Yeah.
What advice would you give to a parent who's recently become a member of the Neurodivergent Child Club?
Find a community of parents who are accepting of you and your child and not judging you for your parenting style that looks different from what they may be doing, or from what the mainstream books that they, you know, bought at Target say is the best way. So finding accepting community is vital. And also adjusting your child's environment so it meets their needs. This can be one of the easiest things to do in the home. School can be more challenging, but when our kids are in the right environment, when I say our, I just mean like a universal, you know, neurodivergent kids. When they are in the right environment, and when their parents have learned certain skills, and their adults who are providing education learn certain skills, these kids can thrive.
You've talked about how important it is that parents of children with autism be staunch supporters of free speech and intellectual autonomy. What does that mean?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. I love this topic. And nobody's talking about it. A few autistic people have brought it up. But so autistic people in general, I'm massively generalizing right now, but common traits are a very strong commitment to what they view as truth and honesty. And even like a really high integrity. So if you want someone to lie for you, don't ask the autistic person, kind of. You know, they're going to say what they think. They're going to mean what they say, and they're going to say what they mean. So when we have all of these social justice speech rules where it's no longer okay to say that, even though this is true, you're no longer allowed to talk about it without being canceled or piled on. This hurts autistic people, because autistic people in general are committed to the truth.
Mm.
And they also do not like to be bossed around. Yeah. There's a very strong love of autonomy in certain presentations of autism. So there's like kind of certain categories, if you will, of like, oh, your autism shows up this way. So for some people, one aspect of their autism is this really strong drive for autonomy. And when they feel their autonomy is being threatened, they will fight back. Trauma response might be a little bit too strong, but there might be like a fight response or a flee, you know, but the desire for autonomy is really strong. So if you're going to threaten intellectual autonomy and say, you're not even allowed to think about that, that doesn't align with the traits of autism. And when I recommend that parents think about this, I do so because parents today are raising youth that are going to be part of these online cultures where they are piling on, where they are canceling and publicly humiliating. So if your autistic child who's maybe a little bit impulsive, committed to the truth, doesn't want to be controlled by anybody, when they say the thing, do you want them to be punished for that? And if not, you should really be a voice for free speech and respectful treatment of one another when we have disagreements.
That is so freaking fascinating. And I have never heard that argument before. I love it. I love it. And so good. What parallels are you seeing in the way that child psychologists are approaching the trans issue with kids and how they first thought that they should treat kids with autism?
Yes. The parallels that I'm seeing is a heavy-handed medicalization approach, a heavy-handed, really powerful interventions that might not be the best. I want to say that I am not a doctor and I'm also not a child psychologist. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and a licensed psychotherapist. When I speak about medical issues, it's from knowledge of the research and what's happening. But some of the parallels are, you know, back in the day, as late as like the 90s, autistic people were treated really badly. They were locked up in institutions. They were subjected to behavior therapy with the use of what we call aversives. This is still happening in some parts of the country. I mean, shock treatment is being used in some parts of the country.
Oh yeah. My gosh. I did not know that.
In some of these residential facilities. Yeah. So, there was a really heavy hand with trying to get these kids to be normal and to fit into a box of what society viewed as normal and acceptable. And some of those behavior therapy practices, today we would look at that as pretty abusive, at the very least disrespectful, but abusive in some cases. So some of the parallels that I argue that these are parallels, we're coming down really heavy-handed with these kids who have gender dysphoria or who are gender non-conforming, gender questioning. We're coming down heavy-handed with the psychological interventions and the medical interventions. So that's where I draw the parallels. And also, I draw the parallels. We struggled to let autistic kids just be different kids. We were really big on correcting them in every way possible. I argue that today we're struggling to accept gender nonconforming kids and just let them be kids. Why do they have to change their name? Why do they have to change their pronouns? Why do they have to claim a different gender if they're just a gender nonconforming girl or boy?
Right.
And that's just the beginning. I mean, the interventions, they just, it's like an assembly line of interventions. So I think that we are struggling to just accept different kids. And we're struggling also to accept kids who are in psychological pain. Mm. This is a hard one. Many of these kids have abuse histories. Trans-identified youth, many of them come from very dysfunctional families. Not all, many. Many have witnessed domestic violence, a history of sexual assault, co-occurring mental illness, depression, anxiety, OCD, autism, ADHD. I think that we're struggling to find the best way forward to support these kids. And instead, we're sort of like scapegoating it all to gender. And then saying, if you go on this gender path, everything will be okay.
Yeah. And we know that's not true based on the testimony from detransitioners who transition as preteens and teens.
Right. For some people, they are very happy with their transition. There's a theory that it takes like 7 to 10 years to really know if you're going to be okay with it. I interviewed someone who was 7 years into their transition, and the way they described it to me in the interview was that they were happy with their transition, but they were not transitioned as a child, and they went through years, over 3 years of intensive trauma therapy.
Mm, yep.
Yeah. And this person who I'm referring to, they remain grounded in reality of biological sex. So that's kind of a different topic, but we have some people like just lying about biological sex, and that really bothers me. But yes, so some people are happy with their transition. Some people who had true gender dysphoria, the clinical mental health diagnosis of gender dysphoria, the intervention for their dysphoria was a transition, and they express happiness with that intervention.
Right.
But we know that that's not the case for all. And in my opinion, that is an adult decision.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Is there anything to suggest that kids with autism may be more susceptible to believing that they're transgender?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There are several reasons for that. One reason is that inherent in the condition of autism is social nonconformity. So if we think of gender as this sort of social thing, which some people subscribe to that, some people don't, but autistic people, they're going to do social things differently. So they might not dress like the other girls. They might not like what the other girls like. They might not understand the social cues. And once girls hit about age 6, their social communication becomes really complex. And autistic girls can feel like, oh, I can't keep up. I don't understand that. So inherent in the condition of autism is a social nonconformity and feeling like you don't belong socially.
Is anybody exploring those statistics?
Of social nonconformity and autism or trans identification and autism?
Trans identification and autism. Is anybody talking about that? How many of these kids that are saying they want to gender transition do have autism? Does that play a part? Like, is anybody talking about it?
Yeah. Yeah. People are talking about this. There was one study in the UK at their Tavistock gender clinic that's about to close down, where as great as I wanted, it was around like 45% of the kids who presented for gender medical treatment were autistic or had autistic traits. A lot of people are talking about this because you can't ignore it. But most of what you hear in the adult autism community is that they support it. They really believe that there's such a thing as like being born in the wrong body kind of thing, and they want to transition. But another risk factor is that autistic people tend to spend a lot of time online for various reasons. And youth in particular, if they're consuming YouTube, social media, they're following these trans influencers. And we are social creatures, and adolescents in particular are very social creatures. They are beginning the process of leaving the nest. And in order to do that, they try to find a peer group to belong to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are these trans online communities that say, hey, you're different. You don't fit in. You don't feel like the other girls. You don't feel like the other boys. Maybe you're trans. And they're very accepting until there's a detransition. Then that changes.
Do you feel like the medical field at all is looking at home life in regards to kids who are experiencing gender confusion, or is that completely looked over?
Oh, it's looked over, because that is not what the medical field does. That is what social workers do and therapists do. We look into the home life. The medical field sees a cluster of symptoms, and the tools that they have are medicine
and surgery.
And surgery. Those are the tools. Those are their hammers. Social workers, out of all the mental health professionals, social workers, we are the ones mostly trained in viewing things more holistically, more complex. The family, what's happening socially, what's in the environment. We have this sort of way of viewing things called person in environment. Now, social workers who are really big on this gender-affirming care style of helping people, they have forgotten about person in environment. They believe that there's this innate thing called gender identity, and their role is to affirm that gender identity. They have put their other training way on the back burner and forgotten that we are social creatures. This is how we're trained. We should be looking at the whole picture.
I love Good Ranchers. You know that I love Good Ranchers. And so I have Ben and Coralie Spell in person with me to explain just why Good Ranchers is superior than just going to the supermarket to get your meat. What is in the meat at supermarkets that every mother really needs to stay away from, and dads too?
Yeah, honestly, you don't really know because they don't tell you.
They say things like we're organic, and really just an organic label I've learned recently doesn't really mean anything.
Whenever I became a mom, in 2017, we had our first baby. That's whenever I did a deep dive into, you know, all the crunchy living, right? The organic chicken that you are seeing at the grocery stores, it doesn't really mean much, because just to have the organic standards, the chicken only really has to have access to an opening outside. It's heirloom quality. It's better than organic. Our chickens are out there
clucking away,
doing the chicken thing.
There's so much greenwashing now.
Yes.
In labeling. It's very confusing for the consumer.
Yeah, and we want people to, whenever they hear the name Good Ranchers, that they trust that name to mean that whatever we're putting out, it's clean. Whatever we're putting out, I'm feeding my family, and I am a crunchy mom. I have 4 children under the age of 5, and I'm making sure everything that goes into their body has no dyes, no GMO, no toxins, all the things.
No antibiotics, no hormones, no GMO corn that they're being fed. This is the best quality you can get. And what I also love, and Coralie and I bonded on this, is that when you get Good Ranchers chicken, you don't have to do all the prep work before you put it on the skillet. It is good to go, which I love. I hate whenever I go to the grocery store, I spend an hour shopping, then I have to go home and spend another several minutes prepping the chicken. It's good to go. It's ready for you. GoodRanchers.com/Clark with code Clark. You will get $30 off today. That's goodranchers.com/Clark with code Clark, or just click the link in the description. Do you think that social workers are made to feel safe if they chose to not go ahead and affirm a child saying that they were experiencing a gender identity crisis?
Great question. And the answer is no, they don't feel safe. They don't feel supported. Depending on the state, there are laws that could hurt them. They could be accused of conversion therapy, even though that's not what they're doing. And social workers and therapists in general We are not here to hurt anybody. It's the opposite of what we do, especially children. But someone in the wrong state can be accused of conversion therapy. Our professional organizations are not very supportive. Thankfully, there are other organizations that are popping up and we're all joining together and we're growing and becoming strong. So we do have support once we make that choice to be that renegade. We have that support, but you really have to have a personality where you're kind of okay being like a lone ranger for a little while. And you also need to be able to withstand pushback from your peers, which takes some time to be able to learn to do that. Yeah.
You have said that in regards to the trans movement, parents and children are a package deal. What do you mean by that?
You do not get to teach our kids something without our involvement. I'm sorry, it does not work that way.
Go off, mama.
Yeah, no. As I've said this on Instagram, parents have a seat at the trans table. When you invite our kids into this framework, this ideology, this theory, you're going to hear from us. We are that mama bear that's always close by. You might see our little cubs out there playing and learning, but trust that the mama bear is close by. And if we think that you're doing anything to threaten our kids, you're going to hear our roar. In the child psychology field and child development field, we know that the parent-child relationship is the most significant relationship for a child. So if you want children to be well, you cannot cut them off from their parents. That's the fastest way to make a child unwell, mm-hmm. is to cut them off from their parents.
I mean, that's the whole reason, even in the foster care system, why the whole goal when your child is placed in foster care, it's always first reunification. It's always less traumatic if that kid can be reunited with their biological parents first.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you brought that up because we understand that as a field. This is field knowledge that we have, yet we're choosing to check it at the door for these activists and their wants. It is vital that the child and parent are working together in whatever is affecting the child. As a child therapist, you can't just drop your child off with me for 1 hour a week and expect that there's going to be a lot of significant improvement in whatever is going on. No, I need to invite you and we need to work as a team. So when I say that we're a package deal, I say that as like an explanation of what we know about child development. And also as a, don't think you're going to walk all over us.
I love it. We need more people like you, Teva.
Thank you.
What can a parent really even say when another adult is asking their child for their pronouns? Like, how should parents be teaching their children to respond to that question also when they're not around?
Yeah. So, oftentimes when parents in my state are enrolling their kids in various programs, the pronouns are requested on like the enrollment sheet. And I'm seeing a lot of parents just ignore that question. I've seen parents write in something a little bit snarky, but you know, I don't recommend that. So I think that if parents know that their child's going to be asked about pronouns because that's the protocol in their school, I think parents should teach their values. So I think that if parents believe that, you know, you could have different pronouns that don't match your sexed body, then, you know, raise your child aligned with your values. If parents don't believe that, then I think that they should prepare their child ahead of time for like, hey, you might be asked some weird questions about pronouns, and kids don't even know what pronouns are. What I would do is I would just really try to teach my values that girls are girls, boys are boys. A girl can be anything she wants. A boy can be anything he wants. If you're playing with the trucks, it does not mean you're a boy. If someone asks if they can call you he, I would say that the child should view that as a weird question, as a straight, like, what? A strange question. And I would probably, you know, depending on the child's developmental stage and their level of curiosity and how bright they are, because bright kids, they don't really settle for simple answers, you know? I would try to explain things in the most kid-friendly way, that some people believe blank, 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 but our family, we don't believe that. Yeah. And we just treat each other kindly and with respect.
How much has child therapy just become customer service and telling people what they want to hear?
Oh, I don't know. Like, I don't really have a feel for the numbers, but there is a trend in the field in general where, yeah, it's about affirmation, which is, that's being a customer service rep. You know, I more support the view of exploration. That's traditional psychotherapy, is you explore. Therapists are not supposed to agree with their clients on everything. But we are in a major ideological chapter where therapists aren't comfortable doing a whole lot of challenging, for various reasons. They've been taught that that's not the right way. They're worried about getting canceled. It's kind of a big deal out there with cancel culture.
What do you think parents should be asking child therapists when they're searching for a therapist? Like, what questions should they kind of be asking them to see if they're going to be pushing that social justice agenda or not?
Yeah. I would probably first check out the therapist's website, because usually therapists who are very interested in the social justice ideological reach into psychotherapy, they're pretty transparent about that on their websites. You'll start to see the key words and the lingo about privilege and oppression and things like that. So parents can get a good idea by just exploring the website. But if they have an opportunity to speak to the therapist first, before, you know, their first appointment, I would say that parents should ask, like, what are your theoretical views on children's mental health?
Right.
What are your, how do you view a gender questioning child? What's your theory behind that? What are some of the interventions that you do? Do you believe that parents should be involved in their child's care? Maybe ask for examples of, like, what are some things that you would share with me? And what are some things that you wouldn't share with me? And you can sort of get a feel for how much the therapist wants to work with parent and how much they have more of a wall up.
Mm, and is that a red flag if a therapist sees more of a wall between them and the parent?
It's tricky. Therapists can kind of be on guard with parents, because we always have to be mindful that there could be abuse happening. So we try to be kind of neutral. It's not good boundaries to get super chummy with parent right away. You really need to slowly build that. But if the therapist does not involve their parents at all, I would say that's a red flag, in just that you're not going to have the most effective treatment, because the child is with the therapist 1 hour a week, and then the child's with you their whole life, all day long. So treatment for whatever it is not going to be that effective if you are cut out.
Right.
Now, sometimes therapists of teens tend to have more of a distant relationship with parents, because they're trying to keep the teen's trust. If the teen thinks that therapist is sharing everything with parent, then teen will not open up as much, and then the work is not going to be as effective. So the therapist really has to walk that line and have clearly stated guidelines and boundaries on how much they involve parents, what they will share and what they won't share. Yeah.
What should a parent do if they do have a child, a small child or even a teenager who is wanting to transition genders, or if they're just gender questioning?
Well, I think that they should seek support from a licensed professional who has a more exploratory child development approach. And there are directories to find those kinds of therapists. I also think that unless the child is showing other behavioral and mental health concerns, parents don't need to like panic. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. You know, it's developmentally typical for some little ones to say that they're a boy when they're really a girl. That's part of child development. So I would hate for a parent to like hear that and then just go rushing into some kind of psychological treatment. That's not necessary. There used to be a practice called watchful waiting that was practiced in Europe. And there's still something to watchful waiting. It's not a heavy hand. But today, many therapists who are not of the automatic affirmation camp, they're saying that watchful waiting might not be enough because kids are consuming so much online about this.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So exploratory therapy with a licensed therapist who has a firm grasp of child development and the many factors that influence children's mental health.
On your Substack, which you call Wrong Think, which is incredible, you have written three reasons why you believe therapists justify giving a child affirming drugs or surgeries when it comes to gender. One of the reasons was because they think the child client will kill themselves. They think that the child was born in the wrong body and that their body can be made right with drugs or surgery. And you write that they think the child client is who they say they are, and so they just want to affirm them. What is the problem with those explanations?
I think that they are unethical. To put it simply, I think that a child who is having gender questioning or gender dysphoria deserves the highest quality of care. And until we explore everything going on, until we treat all those other mental health conditions, until we look at the family relationships and the school and peer relationships, we are selling that child short. And I don't like to see children sold short. So that's kind of my main ethical concern. I also believe that a therapist who thinks that people can be born in the wrong body, that's kind of like a faith-based belief. We don't have science to back that up. So fine if you run a faith-based practice, but if you're just a secular therapist and you're bringing in this like belief system about gendered souls and, you know, pseudoscience that says that a female brain can be born in a male body, I might say you might need to go do some reflection on.
You're so kind the way you're like, you're insane, but you are so nice that you wouldn't say that, but I will say it.
Yeah.
No, you're so right.
I try to be reasonable. Otherwise people stop listening.
Yes, absolutely. And especially in your field of work, I think that's totally the case. But you, the parallels that you're bringing up of, hey, people that say things like a male or female can be born in the wrong body, that's a religion, essentially. Like that is a religious school of thought to kind of go there. It's like a very spiritual thought. That's not scientific. I mean, that right there will make people's heads explode.
Yeah. Yeah. And I support the belief in spiritual ideas. Like I really do. If believe what you want about the spiritual world, but I, as a therapist, don't have to affirm those beliefs. I certainly wouldn't write a letter for surgery.
Yeah.
For what I view to be like kind of religious beliefs. there are faith-based therapists where you would talk about things that are in the supernatural world, but that's not the majority of therapy. And that's not the kind of therapist that I am.
When schools are helping kids transition behind their parents' backs or affirming their gender, could that be considered practicing healthcare without a license?
I argue yes. I'm not a lawyer. However, to become a licensed therapist, we have to learn the law for our state. I argue yes, that's practicing healthcare without a license, because social transition is a potent mental health intervention. And whose consent did you get for that? What training do you have to engage in a potent mental health intervention? I want to see some credentials here. I want to see a clinical license. And if you don't have those things, in my opinion, I argue, that looks to me like practicing healthcare without a license. And if it was my family, I would ask a lawyer about that. There are things that we learn outside of school. And it feels like school is trying to be everything. But that being said, I do want to see gay and lesbian and bisexual youth be supported and know that they're okay. I don't know exactly what that looks like.
I like what you said about schools are trying to be everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything. They're trying to be everything.
They're trying to be the parent. They're trying to be the teacher. They're trying to be the doctor.
Yeah. The therapist. And I just think that if they could stay in their lane and do what they were hired to do, things would be a little bit better.
You know what else I don't understand, Teva, is that these teachers, and rightfully so, most of them, I believe, are underpaid. But it's like you're complaining about being underpaid, but then you want to take on all of these other jobs?
I know. But it's not their decision. It's their leadership making them do this for the most part. I know there are some activist teachers who are gung-ho about, you know, indoctrinating kids who are not theirs. But I think that for the most part, teachers are responding to what leadership is forcing them to do. And these are elected and hired officials, and teachers have very little power. But as far as the gender queer books in the schools, from what I've seen so far, I don't think that they're appropriate, especially for the little ones. I think that gender diversity is a real thing where, like, yeah, there are tomboys. Yeah, there are feminine boys and teens. I think it's okay to see tomboys and feminine boys and teens in books. But as far as teaching, like, this ideology that, like, oh, if you're a tomboy, maybe you're just a boy, I'm not okay with that. I don't want to see that in the schools. And then as far as, like, banning, you know, I'm not in policy, so I don't know the best approach. I understand why there are these bans. And many of them, you know, I would celebrate myself. If there was an inappropriate book in my child's school, I would want to see it gone. I just don't know political policy-wise what's the best way to do these things.
Yeah. How extreme do you feel the tides are going to continue to turn when it comes to this radical gender ideology stuff? Like, is this just the tip of the iceberg and it's going to get worse? Or do you think we've reached the peak of how bad it's going to get?
Peak. Oh, I don't know. I think it's regional dependent. Like, my state just seems to be just doubling down. And it really breaks my heart because it makes it even harder for those of us who are homeschooling to keep a distance from the ideology, because we send our kids to camp. We send our kids to acting class, drama, and it's making its way into, like, everything. And the liberal progressive parents here accept it as normal and okay. They don't only accept it, they celebrate it. But in other states, it seems like things are turning around. It's hard to say. I think that more therapists are getting comfortable speaking up. I think that more therapists are questioning. I know teachers and school counselors are questioning because they contact me in droves, and they tell me what's happening. So I think that as long as we keep a momentum going of courage, and we support each other. So if we see someone that's getting piled on, reach out to that person and let them know that you're supporting them and that what they're saying really matters and that it's okay to take space and it's okay to block people. And, you know, we really need to support each other. And then the tides will turn to hopefully back to some kind of middle space where children are allowed to be gender nonconforming. And when I say that, I mean tomboys, feminine boys, without needing to be something else. We don't have to put them into these boxes. I also worry, that we might get more polarized down the middle with conservative and progressive. Even though I know there's a ton of liberal progressive moms who do not agree with the gender ideology, I know because they follow me and they work with me. It seems like the public message, the mainstream media message, still seems to be that it's a polarized topic. And it's just not true, but it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm.
Yeah.
What would you say to people who are social workers, who are child therapists, who are teachers, and they don't like the direction things are going? Would you say, get out while you still can? Or would you say, we need you in those positions, please don't leave?
I can't really say what a teacher should do because it's not my field. I know so many teachers are leaving the profession. And my heart breaks for what they're going through and all they have on their plate for so little. And most of them enter the profession because they truly care about kids. So I would send like a big virtual hug to those teachers, but I don't know what they should do. Therapists and social workers, I wouldn't say get out while you can. I would say, please stay. We need you. I would say diversify your income streams. That's kind of our new sort of topic that we're talking about.
So what does that mean?
That means make sure you can support your family without your therapy practice in the event that your license gets suspended, taken away. I mean, Jordan Peterson, he's in the news right now. His license is being challenged. Like, this is a thing. Our licenses can be challenged by accusations. It doesn't mean that it's true. And when we go public, we invite eyes. And sometimes those eyes are dishonest. And sometimes we might not get as many referrals. So it's really important that we can still support our families separate from our therapy practice. I myself have made a way. All of my income at this moment is separate from a therapy practice. I'm actually not practicing therapy right at this moment. I'm kind of like a conscientious objector because my state is so ideological and it's against my personal ethics,
yeah,
my personal values. Other therapists I know, they have podcasts, they have Substacks, they do consulting. Yeah.
You call yourself now an institutional advocate, and you say that you want to help parents exit the schools. Now, this sounds like a revolution to me, Teva. So what is the plan?
I want parents to know that if they make the decision, if they say, I'm out of here, I cannot take this, and they want to exit the schools, and they need help, I'm here. I can't tell parents that they should exit the schools, but if they decide that they want to, or they are questioning, I'm here to help them. Now, I'm not an educator, so I can't help parents help their child learn algebra. That's not my field. What I can do is I can help parents make sure that if their child is getting an education outside of school, that their child can stay well socially, mental health, creative, agency, a positive sense of self. I can also help parents who are working mamas who are like, I have a job. How do I do this? I can help those parents with logistics and share, you know, how we do this.
Tava Johnstone, everybody, obsessed with her. This is a must follow Instagram that she has. You've got to follow. So tell us what your Instagram is. Tell us your Substack, any other things. I don't know. Do you sell t-shirts? Tell us all of it.
Yes. Come say hi on Instagram. My new handle actually is, it's Rebel Parents. There's a dot between the two words. So rebel.parents, please come to Instagram. Come say hi. I post numerous times a day, daily. If you want to read some of my longer form writings on like culture war topics, I can be found on Substack. My Substack is tava.substack.com. And then if you want to learn more about consulting with me and some of my online educational offerings that I offer parents, come to tavajohnstone.com.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Tava, for your courage, for your bravery, for speaking out against something that has become sadly so unpopular and taboo when it shouldn't. And you definitely have a conservative friend in me. So I really support you and appreciate you so much. Thank you for coming on The Spillover.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you so much for having me. This was so great to talk about. I appreciate it.
I love that not only did I get to talk about autism with Tava, which I haven't done on this podcast before, but I was also able to connect with someone who I probably don't see eye to eye with politically. And yet, despite that, we both agree that saying no to what licensed professionals are doing to children who are experiencing gender confusion is unacceptable. That we can say, not in my school, to teachers trying to usurp your right as a parent. That's because Tava is a sane person and sane people understand that children cannot make life-altering decisions for themselves. I really appreciate the work that she is doing to help children. So if you liked this episode, then go back and listen to the interview I did with investigative journalist Abigail Schreier, who wrote the book Irreversible Damage. She spent years researching why teen girls are claiming to be trans at record rates. That is season 1, episode 2. And another episode I know you'll like, if you did not listen, is the one where I interviewed Monica Klein. She was a trained comprehensive sex education teacher for a decade, and we talked about what children as young as 9 are being taught, and she was so horrified that she quit her job and is now blowing the whistle on how unnecessarily graphic sex ed is in public schools and how what they're really doing is teaching kids how to enjoy and have sex. Let that sink in. That is season 2, episode 10. Next week, you are getting another health and wellness episode. I know. Actually, you're going to get them for the next 2 weeks. So get excited and leave a 5-star review if you agree that this was an important episode. Watch these interviews by subscribing to Poplitics on YouTube. The Spillover is back next Thursday at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Alex Clark, and this is The Spillover. Love you, mean it. Bye.